from a very keen interest on the events, and but I'm going to follow my wife's suggestion, and I'm going to let the audience, which is very small this time around, to decide whether you want me to talk a little bit about the Soviet case, and or you prefer me to talk a little bit about Venezuela or about Cuba, which may be more current experiences. I have just using bullet points there, like timeline. The case of Venezuela, because much of the events hinge around the figure of Hugo Chavez, so I decided to have the timeline detailed there almost like entirely in terms of Hugo Chavez's recent trajectory. And then the case of Cuba. I lived in Cuba in the 1980s after the Maria boat lift during the Carter administration. To frame this, and you know, before I take a vote, and, let me tell you a little bit about how I look at socialism. I tend to think that the best way to view socialism is not so much as a final destination, a society with a particular configuration, with particular characteristics, but instead, I think that it's better to look at socialism as an organic and radical response by people, some people more than others, to conditions that exist in society, conditions that are degrading to human beings, and that cause that kind of reaction. It's a necessary reaction. It's not a casual reaction. It's not accidental, but it is rather. Sorry about that. It is rather an organic response by people. It comes from deep kind of the essential or the fundamental way in which human beings engage with the rest of nature. As I said yesterday, in Nancy, I think you were here during the forum, human beings tend to problematize the world in the sense that they start with a certain notion or a certain idea, and then they take a chunk of nature and then they transform it, or they try to transform it in accordance with that idea or design. And not always the outcome of this process is exactly the product that people have in mind. There may be unintended consequences. The actual product may be different, but there is going to be some product, and part of that product is actually that a human being that emerges out of the process is different from the human being that starts the process. It's a transformed human being. And so I started the series of conversations here, like say, well, how can we define, how can we describe or denote those social conditions that bother us so much to such extent that, you know, we experience this kind of a passion to change things, that, you know, we want to transform things, and not being contented just with addressing the symptoms of those offensive things that exist in society, but we want to go all the way and uproot, remove the roots or the sources of those social ills. And the term that I use, which comes from the intellectual tradition in which I grew up politically, which is Marxism, is the term that is used is alienation, social alienation. So where the term describes the fact that we produce something, we produce, let's call it wealth, and we produce something, and then the output of our effort, the product, escapes our control, becomes an alien force, hence alienation, right? Becomes an alien force that turns against us and oppresses. And that happens very clearly in the economic, in the economy, to the extent that we create economic conditions that backfire on us. Like the typical example I use is that of a farmer, say in the Midwest, that grows corn or soybean, and then the price of soybean, the price of corn drops, and it's catastrophic for a farmer. And it's almost like a natural phenomenon, as if, you know, there is a hurricane or a tornado or something. It's not a tornado, it's not a natural event. It is a social event. It's something that human beings and the way they produce, the way they are organized to produce and distribute wealth, etc., that it's something that results out of that, right? The prices result out of the haggling or negotiations between buyers and sellers of soybean or corn. But, you know, prices are not within our control, are not controlled by us as individuals, right? So to that extent, we are enslaved by our own creations, or we are the victims of our own creations. And that's the phenomenon that we call alienation. And then the opposite of that, and I said, you know, whenever we see something that bother us, right? Like, for example, you know, another example I've been using in this conversation is like, imagine that there is garbage in the road. There is garbage in the road. Immediately, our mind is going to envision a road that is clear and clean and functional. And, you know, cars can pass by, people can, etc. And similarly, if we have a phenomenon of social alienation, right, where human beings produce political institutions or economic institutions that, you know, seem like a ship that they cannot steer in the desired direction, right, that actually it kind of moves in opposite direction to what where we want it to go, then the opposite of alienation would be owning society, right? Being like fully in control, or, you know, to a large extent in control of the things that we produce, right? Of that wealth that we produce. And we define wealth not only like ordinary wealth, but also because whenever we produce wealth, we also produce social structures or social relations, even if temporary, but sometimes they are more stable. But we produce certain social structures, and we like, for example, like families, or, you know, or organizations such as Holden Village, organizations such as, you know, business firms, etc., governments, right? The opposite of social alienation would be the reappropriation of society, of our social conditions, placing them under our control as individuals. Right? But in our conversations, I think I try to make the point that, from my point of view, it's kind of paradoxical, because it seems that the only way in which we can gain freedom as individuals is by becoming like fully socialized, by embracing the fact that one way or another we have to cooperate among us. We have to cooperate with one another. The market, which is a form of social structure, a particular historical form in which people help people, kind of foster the illusion that people are self-reliant, because we are cooperating with others, we're helping others and being helped by others, but we do it not for the sake of helping. We are not really looking at the other person as an individual with their needs that are our concern, etc. We really are using the other individual just as a vehicle for our own ends. And so it's kind of a perverse form of social cooperation. We are effectively cooperation. I'm giving you this, you're giving me that. Scratch your back, you scratch my back. But that process of back scratching, mutual back scratching, is regulated by prices, by the haggling between buyers and sellers of back scratching. And to that extent, we feel like comfortable. Okay, that's the rate at which I scratch my back scratching for yours. And but it's not like the type of social cooperation that, for example, we observe here in Holden Village, or in a family, in a typical family, in even in the most capitalist, market-oriented type of economy or society, we will see that there is a whole sphere of social relations where things are not regulated that way. They are not regulated by prices. You know, we feed our babies, mothers feed their babies, without really thinking of, you know, expecting anything in return, at least, you know, in the immediate future, you know. So like, you know, when your kid goes and opens the refrigerator, you have to pay the price of milk, you know. It's another way in which resources are managed inside of a family, inside of a firm, a business firm. It's very hierarchical, etc. So we talk about all that, and now I didn't shy away from using the term socialism to describe that process of appropriation of social conditions, right? Because it's precisely moving in the opposite direction to alienation. That's what I call socialism. And so socialism is not only questioning, again, the symptoms, but going after the roots. If you are critical of your government, critical of your political leadership, you are not only critical of the particular individuals that are representing you in Congress or the particular president that you have, you are questioning the whole set of institutions that those people are on top of. And you are questioning even, you know, the notion of leadership. Why should some people be the thinkers and others be the doers? Why should some people plan and others execute? What should people? Some people issue orders, others, you know, follow them, etc. But you kind of envision an alternative to that, a society that would have other type of social structures where even the need for this separation between a political system and civil society would disappear. And the same with economic relations, establishing mutual relations among human beings or cooperation, because every society is based on cooperation. Production of any kind of wealth is based on cooperation, but in a direct way, without the mediation of, for example, markets, where again, you know, you are doing it not for the sake of helping, but because it's a way to attain your ends. And that kind of fosters this individualistic view of the world that, in a sense, erodes the basis of a society, of a lasting society. So anyways, I didn't shy away from using the word socialism, I just said, even though I know that it's a notion that may be shocking to people, you know, for historical reasons. And the history of the Soviet Union is clearly tragic. But it's a little bit like, say, Lutherans, right? Lutherans don't shy away from using for invoking the name of Christ, even though in the name of Christ, many crimes have been committed in human history. And so it's like there is something about the name and the life and the example of Christ, the New Testament, etc., that inspires Christians, and to the extent that in spite of the history of Christianity, you know, they want to recover the name and they want to, they want to honor it. And I kind of have that kind of a sense about socialism, that, you know, there is a tradition, it's an intellectual, philosophical, political tradition that goes all the way back even to ancient civilizations, like, you know, Greek philosophers and Middle Age thinkers like Thomas More in England, etc. And yes, it's also the Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels tradition, that emphasize the search for the agent that would precisely move from this state of social alienation all the way to this state of reappropriation of our social relations, right? And they thought that it's something that, by the way, touches with Christianity. It has certain commonalities with a Christian approach, which says that the Sermon on the Mountain, right? Where are you going to find that force that is going to be the less vested, the less vested in the status quo, which is a group of people that have the least interest in preserving the social conditions that exist, and those who want to, you know, more than any other segment of society, to transform the world. And Karl Marx and Engels taught, you know, workers who don't have really property, who are propertyless, so they are alienated, right? If they are construction workers, they build houses, they build buildings, they build bridges, they build roads, but it's not for them. You know, it's for the sake of someone else. And so those people, not Marx did it, or Engels didn't say that those people, that workers were ready-made for a revolution. They thought that actually they were not ready-made for a revolution. They were at the bottom of society, they were oppressed, and they were, obviously, if the status quo was being upheld, that meant that those people were ideologically disarmed, politically disorganized, divided, etc. And actually was the process of unity, the process of struggling, resisting the oppression, that would lead them to build themselves up as that force that would transform society. But it would, you know, they didn't guarantee that it was going to be like an easy process or anything like that. You know, I'm saying this because some people sometimes say, you know, like, how about the United States? Isn't that refutation of the, you know, of the predictions of Karl Marx, who thought that workers would be radical and revolutionary? And in my understanding, no, that's not a refutation. It's why capitalism exists in the United States? Well, because, you know, either because some people are actively promoting it and defending it, and other peoples are just, you know, passive and accepted or tolerated by omission. And among them, you know, workers, right? Workers may be actually actively promoting capitalism or tolerating it, at least, right? They haven't managed to organize themselves into that revolutionary force. Anyway, this is a very long preamble, but so that you see where I come from. And so, as tragic as the experience of the Soviet Union is, and because of the tremendous differences in historical circumstances that exist between, say, Russia in 1917 and the United States of America in the 2000s and 2010s, the 2010s. So to that extent, right, the experience of the Soviet Union may not be really relevant to the case of the United States. For example, in Russia in 1917, they hadn't experienced anything like a French Revolution, or like an American independence revolution, you know, with this intellectual ferment of individual freedom, the assertion of the rights of human beings as individuals. So actually, Russia in 1917 was still ruled by a monarch, by a king, by a tsar, who ruled an empire, and so it was overthrown in March of 1917, and then the Bolsheviks overthrew that government, the government that overthrew the tsar, in November of 1917. And the reasons for that were that government was very weak. Russia was engaged in a war, in World War I, and people were very discontent with that war. There was a famine, people dying from hunger, and peasants had been struggling for land for a long period of time. They had been deceived. There had been a fake land reform in the late 19th century, and so peasants were very discontent with the conditions, and they wanted the land. And so under those conditions, the Bolsheviks took power forcefully, and then that's how the whole experiment began. So that's the case of the Soviet case. I could say more about it. And on Venezuela, in 1992, a colonel of the armed forces in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, led an attempt to overthrow the government of Carlos Andrés Pérez in Venezuela. Carlos Andrés Pérez presided over a brutal economic crisis in Venezuela. Oil prices were low, and the government of Venezuela, which was highly indebted to U.S. banks and to European banks, implemented a series of economic policies that were pushed by the IMF, by the International Monetary Fund, which is pretty much ruled by the U.S. Treasury. And those reforms were, you know, you have to privatize public companies, the oil company, which is like, which is PDVSA, is a state-owned company. And Venezuela has also other natural resources, mineral resources, like aluminum and iron and water power, etc., on the Orinoco River Basin. And all that wealth was looked after by foreign companies. And so there was this pressure on the IMF and on Venezuela to implement these policies. These policies led to a revolt, a spontaneous revolt of people. The government repressed that, killed a lot of people. And then Chavez, who was in the armed forces, just couldn't stand for that. And he turned against the government. He tried to lead this coup d'etat. It failed. Chavez went to jail for a couple of years, I think. And then, in 1994, he was pardoned by a new government. And then he became very popular because there was still a lot of discontent. The economy was just stagnant and even going down. And so in 1998, he was elected president. He ran a campaign against the Miss Universe, but he won. And he was elected president. That's the case of Venezuela. The case of Cuba in 1959, the government of Fulgencio Batista, which was backed by the U.S., was overthrown by Fidel Castro, who had been trying for years, since he was very young. He was involved in politics, and he was trying to overthrow him. And finally, he succeeded. He led an armed guerrilla war from the eastern mountains of Cuba. And so he succeeded. And that's what began the Cuban process. So that's the preamble. I guess if you have questions or comments or you have a particular interest in something, I'll be glad to try to help with that. Oh, should I take a vote?
I thought you were going to ask which, you know.
Yeah, I kind of changed my mind on the course, right?
Okay.
Okay, so.
Yeah, it's okay.
But I think that now people have the, you know, now the audience can say what they want, and then we'll adjust. Yeah.
What are you asking?
Well, yeah. Which particular case, for example, would you think that is more interesting to you, individually? Yeah.
I'm curious about Cuba, Vietnam, Angola, and Ethiopia.
Okay. Yeah, that was an epic intervention, I would say. In the early 1970s, Angola finally succeeded in becoming independent from Portugal. The Portuguese they colonized a big chunk of the southern cone of Africa, not South Africa, but you know the neighbor countries on the northwest of South Africa, Mozambique, and basically Mozambique and Angola. Angola has oil in the north. And then a few states and islands on the western center western African region. And Angola, when Angola was about to consolidate its independence, a government, an independent government, the Portuguese and also apparently the CIA was involved, was sabotaging that government, and the government of the MPLA came to the United Nations and asked the United Nations for support, and the United Nations passed a resolution that it wasn't objected by the Security Council, which can be vetoed by the U.S. So the U.S. was doing something kind of underground, wasn't doing it overtly because it was after the Vietnam shock, the Vietnam trauma. So the U.S. was playing the Cold War, was fearful that the Soviet Union could get into that region of Africa. So that was the U.S. concern. It didn't want the Soviet Union to control that part of Africa, and so they were sabotaging the MPLA because they were leftists, and they weren't really allied with the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union really didn't have much interest in helping them at that point. There was some help by the Soviet Union, but it was kind of almost forced. Fidel Castro kind of imposed, you know, a fait accompli on the Soviets. The Soviets just couldn't stop Fidel Castro. But the initiative to help Angola, which by the way was legal internationally under the resolution of the United Nations, so that there's no controversy there. You know, of course, you know, the American media, the New York Times, for example, condemned the intervention of Cuban troops in Angola, but didn't deem it illegal. It was immoral, it was for the wrong reasons, whatever, but it wasn't illegal because it was perfectly legal. So the Cubans helped Angola, but to, you know, to avoid problems, they did it in a secret way. They shipped the troops to Africa secretly. And when the Americans realized, there were already several thousand Cuban troops in Angola. And then there was a kind of an ebb and flow of the fight. But you know, the Cubans immediately helped the Angolans, and the Angolans were going to stabilize their control, except that South Africa invaded Namibia and then also invaded Angola. And South Africa was a pariah country. It was only held by Israel overtly and underground by the U.S. Israel gave the South Africans the nuclear weapon. So they had nuclear weapons. And they were going to throw them against the Cubans. But for some reason, they didn't pull the trigger. But it was pretty close. So the Cubans then faced the Cubans and the Angolans. They faced the South African troops. And it's the first major battle or major war that has been won by black Africans against whites. In this case, the South African regime, the South African army. So they defeated them in Quito Canavale. Fidel Castro commandeered the battle from Havana. And so they won. The South African army was defeated. They had to pull them back. They pulled back the troops to South Africa. And as a result, Namibia's independence was also ensured. And also South Africa, a few years later, Nelson Mandela was released from prison. And then the apartheid regime that kept segregation between blacks and whites in South Africa, blacks segregated to small kind of reservations in South Africa, the majority of the territory being held by the minority, white minority of the population. So that regime fell apart, and then Nelson Mandela was elected president. So that's kind of a brief summary of what happened in Angola. So Nelson Mandela came to Cuba to thank Fidel Castro. He also stopped here in Washington, and Ronald Reagan received him. And Ronald Reagan didn't want him to go to Cuba, but Nelson Mandela said, of course I'm going to Cuba. The negotiations after the South Africans were defeated for the Cubans to be brought back to Cuba were held in New York, and the Cubans brought all their troops, all their soldiers back to back home, and that is one of the what Cubans call, you know, gestures of internationalism that makes the Cubans the most proud. That thing was blemished by a drug traffic scandal that one of the generals, one of the Cuban generals, was involved in. He was involved assisting Escobar, one of the drug lords in Colombia, to smuggle drug into the United States. And that was a big brouhaha that guy was executed, was judged in Cuba, and he was executed, he and other people who played some role in that. And of course, you know, there was a lot of criticism about how the trial was conducted, and whether it was a fair trial, or whether, you know, Fidel Castro himself and Raúl Castro themselves were involved in this decision to help the Colombian cartel, the Cali cartel, to smuggle drugs into the United States, all those things. I don't know, but I don't think so. Personally, I don't think so. And of course, you know, Fidel Castro denied it, and there is a video that's now on YouTube that was just for the consumption of members of the Communist Party of Cuba, where the whole trial was explained, and they videotape even the execution of these people, and it's kind of disturbing. It's all on YouTube, the whole series, and it hasn't been played in Cuba on TV, but many people in Cuba, I would say like 90% of Cubans, adult Cubans, have watched that. And because the Communist Party played that for people who were either members of the Communist Party or very close to the Communist Party in Cuba. So a large percentage of the population watched that. And it was like to explain the people of Cuba, especially those closer to the Communist Party, there is only one party that is legal in Cuba, and that's the Communist Party. Fidel Castro wanted them to know what had happened, give them his version of the events. So that's the story about Miguel.
Huh? Is Fidel still alive?
He's still alive. He had a crisis. You know, he had a stomach problem. He had stomach surgery, but he's back in shape. I mean, he's old.
Is it kind of the power behind? Is that his brother, Raúl?
Yeah, Raúl Castro is in power. He is fully in power.
I often wondered if maybe he wasn't kind of the laying power behind his brother.
No. Raúl Castro is fully in control. Oh. Fidel Castro, in 2011, in February 2011, this year, they held they held the 6th Congress of the Communist Party of Cuba, and Fidel Castro didn't accept any nomination or anything for party positions. Which, you know, government positions, he abandoned them in 2006. In 2006, he resigned to all his charges, all his positions in government. But he retained the general secretary of the Cuban Communist Party, which is the leader of the Communist Party. And that was apparently people who I kind of rely on in terms of inside information. Told me that Raúl didn't want Fidel to leave that position. He wanted Fidel to retain that position. But he was, for a little while, because he was sick and recovering, he couldn't really like even exercise his role as leader of the party. So effectively, it was Raúl that was also leading the party. And they're moving Raul in 2011. In this Congress, they pass a resolution of the party, the ruling party, that they are gonna have periods. What is that? Limits.
Term
limits. So now Raul is kind of suggesting that he's gonna be subject. That has to be passed by the government, by the party, which rules the government. Told the government we want term limits, including term limits for his own position, Raul Castro's position. That was something unexpected. Nobody expected that to happen.
Yeah.
Not Washington. And so, anyways, yes, he is in control. Raul Castro is more of a systems guy. Fidel is more of a micromanager and a storm campaign type of guy. You know, he's not very good at setting up the structures that function, kind of robust structures that will function without him. It's just, you know, temperaments are very different.
Are there any other, do they allow any other faiths over there at all, other than the communists?
Other
ideal? Any faiths or any other religions?
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah. Well, the Pope has visited Cuba.
Eclipsed by Monica Lewinsky.
By Monica Lewinsky? Yeah, they...
I didn't remember that. The United States because of the Monica Lewinsky.
I didn't remember that.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That point. Well, Cuba had a very active and very nice relationship with the American Council of Churches that used to be led by this pastor... the name escapes me. He died, a black pastor, African-American pastor. He died. He actually helped Cuba a lot. During the years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Cuba depended on the Soviet Union for two things, basically. One was oil supply at very low prices. And number two, sugar purchases. The Soviet bought most of the sugar that Cuba produced. So that was the relationship between them. And then when the Soviet Union collapsed, the market for sugar went down for Cuba, and the supplier of oil, Cuba had to buy oil in the open market at very high prices, so the economy shrunk. It shrunk like one third, probably more than one third of the economy just evaporated as a result of that. It was really brutal. That was the period that was called the special period. It's from 1991 to the late 1990s. Then Cuba recovered gradually. There was a protest. This is kind of telling of the way, you know, the politics of Cuba. In 1994, there were spontaneous protests in the Malecon. Fidel kind of hinted that he was going to allow, if the Americans didn't introduce like a little bit of order in the immigration policies, because the Americans, if you couldn't get a visa in Havana to come to the United States in the 1990s when Cuba was like experiencing like near starvation situation, in order to emigrate to the United States, you had to try to get there illegally, to get to the U.S. illegally. Once you were in the U.S., then you would appeal to the law where, you know, political prosecution, etc. So you would be protected by the U.S. and then you immediately get the green card as a Cuban citizen. Something that doesn't happen to anybody else but just Cubans. So it was a way to encourage desertion or, you know, to encourage people from to leave Cuba but in illegal ways. And what Cuba wanted was, you know, visas. You know, let's have visas here for Cubans who want to leave. They can receive visas here in the embassy, or, well, they don't call it embassy, they call it the Office of Special Interest. The U.S. has a representation in Cuba. Cuba has a representation in Washington. It's not an embassy because they don't have diplomatic relations, but they do it to the Switzerland's embassy, the Swiss embassy. The Swiss embassy in Washington has a wing that is the Cuban Office of Special Oficina de Intereses. Yeah. So anyways, Fidel hinted that he was going to allow people to just leave Cuba and that he was even going to assist them, because, and he was going to try to protect them so that sharks, or, you know, like, they didn't die up to, you know, the territorial waters of Cuba. And then from that point on, they were on their own. That was what Fidel said. And then people, like, started to try to build rafts and things like that. And so there was a protest, and people started to throw rocks at the, you know, at the buildings and public buildings and things like that. And so Fidel Castro went there directly to talk to the protesters that were throwing rocks and all that. And he ordered the cops, the Cuban cops, not to fire at them. And he went there, he talked to them, and then the protest kind of swing and turn in favor of Fidel. That was kind of a very Cuban thing for that to happen. It's a very conflicted relationship that people have with Fidel Castro. Even nowadays, you know, like, many people who are with the revolution were happy to see Fidel Castro kind of leave the scene. And because, you know, he has a lot of moral authority, but as an administrator or as a manager or, you know, helping really, Cuban society to control the economy and to, you know, produce more wealth, I think that aside from the fact that Cuba has had very adverse circumstances, right, because of the blockade, what the U.S. called it, the embargo, also there have been, like, very serious failures in economic policy. That is my personal view.
What about this?
Oh, about the religions. Yeah, they're all, yeah.
And what is it about the socialist experience there that you appreciate? Because you're sort of...
Well, to me personally, Cuba is a big mixed bag, but, you know, I don't feel that I have the authority or even the moral authority or the right to tell the Cubans how to do things. My attitude is of respect towards Cuba, in part because I benefited from the Cuban Revolution, because I was helped by the Cuban Revolution. Like, I was helped also by U.S. taxpayers. I went to a public university in New York. So, like, I also have a kind of a similar sense of loyalty just to Americans in that sense. So, if I lived in Cuba, then the situation would be different. If I were a Cuban, the situation would be different. And I think that anything that I may say, like, extremely negative about Cuba, you know, it would somewhat contribute, whether I like it or not, to the attempt to choke, you know, to strangle the Cuban Revolution. And I think that there is a legitimate plebeian content of that process that is the reason why that revolution still survives, in spite of the fact that the Soviet Union failed and that they, you know, they were in very dire circumstances after that. So I respect the Cuban process. I have a sense of respect. I can see, well, but they can only do what they can do with the resources that they have. I mean, just taking into consideration that in 1961, 99% of the medical specialists, you know, the professionals of medicine, doctors, etc., nurses, qualified nurses, left Cuba. Teachers left Cuba. The best minds, well, I don't know if the best minds, but some of the best minds in different fields of knowledge left Cuba early on. And then during the Mariel boat lift, some also left Cuba. So Cuba can only do what it can do with the resources that it has, including the human resources that they have. So, and they have done remarkable things in the field of education, healthcare. In healthcare, they have a life expectancy of like 70-something, 80 years, 70-something, according to the World Bank, the Cubans claim a little bit higher number. Child mortality is very low, and the Cuban doctors are helping everywhere, in many countries in the world, in Africa, in Haiti. They are very active also in South America, Cuban teachers also in literacy campaigns everywhere. And the Cuban education and public health care system deteriorated somewhat as a result of the special period, but then they recovered to some extent. Now they have a little bit more of, for-profit medicine. Especially, it depends on need. If it's an individual who is deemed wealthy, then that person has to pay, wants to be, operated in Cuba or something, get a treatment in Cuba. Cuba provides a lot of medical services in Latin America to everybody. But if you are rich or rich middle class, then they charge you. If you are poor, they do it for free. And, blindness, they do all sorts of operations for people. They go to the jungle in the Amazons, and they cure people for free, virtually for free. They have assisted the Venezuelan process, the Hugo Chavez government, with doctors because...
Even Chavez himself.
Chavez just recently had a health crisis in Cuba. And he was treated in Cuba. He was intervened surgically in Cuba and all that. And so it's Cuba and Venezuela are trying to build, and Bolivia and Ecuador are trying to build something like a trade union. It's called the ALBA, Alternativa Bolivariana para las Americas. And there are other countries that are kind of halfway in there, like Brazil or even Colombia. We used to be a very staunch ally of the United States, has kind of cooled down a little bit its relationship with the U.S.
You know our church, and we sent a delegation to the Cuban church. But we have a family who's real interested in Cuba, and we like Cuba, our church.
Yeah, Cuba. Yesterday, somebody was saying that one of the things that happened during the special period was that it forced Cuban towards a small urban farming, organic farm production. And yeah, I mean, a lot of adjustments had to be made because of the lack of oil. So in transportation, etc., in farming, and they had to rely on a lot of urban farming. And that has been kept. Even now, you go to Havana and you see a lot of those things. Not that I have been recently, but I've seen pictures. It's interesting. They got into organic farming not because because they had any idea what that was and how beneficial that would be, but it was by default because of the conditions in which they were, and now they kind of understand and they have rationalized it, and now they are in favor of that. And there is a push towards farming in Cuba. The problem is that the population is highly educated and they want to live in the cities. They don't want to go and do the back-breaking work that is required in farming. And so Cuba is now they are basically giving land away, farm land away, that used to belong to the state, but that, for one reason or another, the government just couldn't do anything with that land. They are granting that to private individuals in perpetuity, even. Like, you can keep it forever. And it's still going to be public property, but you can keep it and you can use it and you can sell the produce they have to pay taxes and all that, but it's a pretty good deal. So they are trying to, and apparently is yielding some results. That's one of the policy lines of this recent Congress, and also allowing people to allowing people to work on their own, like self-employed or freelancers and things like that. They are allowing all that. And they are doing it very carefully because they don't want like people to steal raw materials from the state sector and funnel them towards the private sector and things like that. But they are trying to tighten more like the fiscal regulations, taxation and all that, because they don't have experience in that area. And so, that's one of the goals of this reform, to try to foster that kind of thing, which makes a lot of sense. Trade in Cuba, like some leftists are critical of that. They say, like, why didn't Fidel Castro try to grant, you know, the control of companies to the workers themselves? Why didn't Raúl Castro or whoever may be the person in power, you know, why didn't they allow workers to self-manage their companies, their productive units and all that? And I posed that question to some of my friends in Cuba, and what they emailed me in answer was, there is no movement of workers reclaiming, claiming that they want to control their workplaces. For the most part, they would need time to do that, and they don't want to spend more time in their workplaces. They have other things to do. Democracy is costly. People have to spend time in meetings and making decisions and all that, and the Cubans are kind of tired of that thing. And maybe because, you know, it has proved to be kind of formulaic and just ceremonial, but not effective. But the fact is that there is no movement. There is no grassroots movement where people are saying, claiming, and we want to control our workplace. You know, we factory workers want to control how this factory does business. No, the workers are not saying that. And so, it seems like what some critical leftists are saying about that, you know, it's not really relevant. And in trade, you know, people are definitely in favor of that. People think that it's going to help the economy bounce back. And that is what is really going on at the, you know, at the ground level. And and I think, you know, I've been saying that trade in itself is cooperation. It's just a form of cooperation that may not be the most the one that propitiates greater development of socialist-social relations. It is true that it seems to be like a step backwards. But in the case of Cuba, I think that it's actually a step forward, because they need to solve their necessities. They don't have time, in part because they have to spend a long hours just solving their more basic necessities, trying to acquire the most basic goods. People spend a tremendous amount of time in Cuba, or used to spend even more so during the special period, of course, standing in line, waiting for the ration, you know, because there was rationing in Cuba, you know, a certain basket of goods that was given at a very low subsidized prices to every Cuban family. But people had to stand in line. So it's cheap, but it's expensive because you are spending your day there. Right? And then, of course, if you have a grandmother who can do that for you, that's great. But what if you are a young family? So those kind of problems are the real problems that they face. I think I'm done with my time, and I really enjoy this 2 weeks here.